When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And we don't just mean the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out, the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
And I'm Ben.
And Ben, you know what? Before we get started here, before we get deep into things, I just wanted to mention that today's topic is about Toyota.
Right.
And Toyota is a sponsor on our site, but we're going to give the pros and cons here, an unbiased view. So I just want to throw that out there and let everybody know that. But I just thought it was something we should mention.
Yeah, I agree. But let's get into it now that we're done with the paperwork.
Sounds good.
This, let's be honest, this podcast was something that we had talked about before, and this actually comes from a listener suggestion.
Mm-hmm.
And I am sorry I couldn't hunt down the email today, but I am going to find it and give this guy a shout out.
I think we mentioned this in a Nuts and Bolts episode, that somebody wanted to hear some of the fascinating stories of other auto manufacturers besides Henry Ford, because everybody hears the Ford story.
Everybody knows the Ford story, which is what the listener said.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So there's a lot of other stories out there, and one of them happens to be Toyota.
And that is what we're going to talk about today.
That's right. Yeah.
Wouldn't it be funny if it was like one of them is Toyota, but what we are going to talk about?
No, we're definitely talking about the Toyota history here, because it goes back, a lot farther than you might think at this point. Because, you know, I was shocked to read this. I don't know why I was, but I was. Toyota's been in America for over 50 years at this point, Ben.
Yes.
50 years. I didn't realize. I would thought it would have been more like 30 plus.
And they've been a company, for much longer than that.
Much longer. That's
much
right.
Longer.
Yeah. Since what? 1957, since it came to the United States. But, it even goes back farther than that, really.
Yes. Let's go. Actually, you know what? As one of the characters in Alice in Wonderland said, let's start at the beginning. We'll go through the middle. Oh, we can't stop at the end, though, because the story is, fortunately, not over.
Still continuing. That's
still
right.
Continuing.
Yeah.
Well, so we'll end on like a cliffhanger.
Sounds good.
All right. But let's start with Sakichi Toyota. Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
I'm
that's
butchering
right.
It. Like,
no, I think that's right.
Okay. Everyone.
Spelled with a D, by the way.
Yes. Toyota with a D. Everyone listening who does speak or understand Japanese, please be kind, because we're about to venture out.
There may be a couple of terms here that we may blow on the way, but we'll do our best.
We'll do our best.
Yeah.
And Sakichi is born in 1867 in Japan. He was an inventor, and he was actually, from what we understand, quite a prolific and tenacious inventor. One of the big inventions that he made had nothing to do with cars.
That was where he got to start.
Yeah, his breakthrough invention is an automated loom. Right?
Yeah, isn't that crazy? I mean, you would think – now, of course, you know, machinery and automation and, you know, that kind of goes hand in hand. But
sure.
To go from creating an automated loom to, well, what's now an enormous auto company.
Yeah, a conglomerate.
Strange. But remember the time. This is the dawn of the automobile.
Mm-hmm.
This is the beginning of it. I mean, relatively new at that point.
Sure. And that's 1924 when Sakichi invents the – Toyota Model G automatic loom. Just a few years later, about 5 years later, he sells the patent for this loom to a British company, and they give him what? They give him like $1 million or something?
A million yen, I think. Who knows what that would be now? I'm just not exactly sure. I haven't done the conversion, but apparently it's quite a bit of money because he used that to found this this fledgling automobile company.
Yes, because even though they had the loom business and things were – he made more than one invention concerning looms, but he was doing quite well as an inventor in this loom business. But Sakichi had a moment, Scott, where he looked around and he said, you know what? Looms are all right, but cars are the future. And
– cars are the business.
Cars are the business.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Build cars.
Yeah. Well, he actually started with like gasoline-powered engines.
Right.
So Toyota started out as an engine manufacturer, really.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it was really, it wasn't even called Toyota at that point because, we're still talking 1930 at this point.
Right.
And it wasn't until 1937 that the Toyota Motor Company Limited, I should say, is established. Mm-hmm. So, there's 7 years in between there and he's actually working on a vehicle as well, you know, towards the end of that, you know, the AA sedan is one of the vehicles that he worked on, the year prior to, the launch of the Toyota Motor Company.
Now let's introduce a new character.
Okay.
In this, because Sakichi Toyota passed away in 1930 when he was 63, but before he did, and this was toward the end of his life,
mm-hmm.
when he converted, so much of the business, or business goals, at least, into an automotive industry. He told his son, now let me butcher this one.
I think I got it here.
You got it? Will you do
maybe.
It?
Is it Kichiro?
It sounds like it, but there's two I's. Kichiro.
I don't know. Maybe it's like Hawaii.
Yeah, well, we don't want. They're going to kill us, Scott.
Oh, I know.
They're going to kill us.
Okay, that's fine.
So he tells his son.
Yeah.
He tells his son, basically, look, build cars. And when he tells Kichiro this, Kichiro starts doing the research on these engines actually in the same year that Sakichi passes away. And as you say, it's a long time, 7 years before they actually establish the Toyota Motor Company. And most of that, the thrust of that is really Kichiro following through on the agreement that he made with Sakichi. And this is where we start to see – now we're going to have like a kind of parallel thing here with the history.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the reasons that we decided to do a podcast on Toyota is because they actually have sort of a unique mentality among car makers.
Oh, very unique. Well, you know what? It's not as unique as it once was.
It's catching on.
And exactly. The reason is others are copying what they started with. Now they have these, there's a Toyota production system.
Mm-hmm.
There are these guiding principles that they follow.
Yeah, the precepts.
It's hard to explain, but it's a way of life really in the factory.
It's surprisingly philosophical.
It really is. Now, we've talked briefly, I think, about the Toyota production system. Have we done a full podcast on that?
No, not a full one.
Really? Okay.
I don't think so.
I'm surprised we haven't. But basically, this is the philosophy of the complete elimination of all waste.
Yes.
It's doing away with anything that's unnecessary. The pursuit of the most efficient methods in production for automobiles. And this Toyota production system has been extrapolated to healthcare. It's been extrapolated to machine shops. It's
retail
been,
supply chains.
Exactly. Retail. You're talking about like even grocery stores, everything. And of course, other automakers have jumped on board with this. And it's often called lean manufacturing or just-in-time systems.
Just-in-time is the name I like.
Yeah, just-in-time is what a lot of people call it. And again, it's kind of like a worldwide sensation, you know, that this thing has caused. And it originates with Toyota, this Toyota production system. That's often the name that's associated with it.
Right.
What do you want to get into the concepts of this just real quickly?
Yeah.
All right. There's two concepts that the Toyota production system follows. And one is Jidoka. Is that right?
I mean, it sounds appropriate. I would just say spell it so listeners know.
J-I-D-O-K-A. Jidoka. And that's really what that really means is automation with a human touch, And of course, that means when a problem happens, the equipment stops, the whole line shuts down, they fix the problem. And what that does is that prevents defective products from continuing through the line and just furthering the problem. They don't have to fix that many more vehicles later. They find a solution immediately for the problem.
Could I interject real quick?
Sure.
This baffled Western auto manufacturers because of a very strange thing that you didn't see in Western assembly lines at the time. They have every operator in some of these factories had the ability to stop the line.
Ooh, yeah.
If they saw a problem.
And you know why they wouldn't like that?
Well, because you can be, I think the expression I read, when we're doing research is a Western automobile worker could be fired on the spot for just stopping the line.
Yes. And the reason is the amount of money that costs the corporation per second, per minute, however you want to measure it. It's an enormous amount of money for an automobile production line to shut down. It doesn't matter, you know, what size company, as long as you're not producing, you're not making money.
You're just bleeding
and
money.
It really is. It's a high, high dollar amount per minute. And to do something like this and to solve a problem and to get it back up and running again, that's got to take, you know, it's going to take some time. It's not something you can fix in 10 seconds typically.
Right. No matter who you are.
Exactly. Yeah. So this was contrary, to what they had been taught that, you know, you just continue on and you tell somebody about it later and they fix the problem and, you know, they'll catch up with it later.
Now that's the first, principle that you talked about. What's the second?
The second is, this whole concept of what you said before, the just in time concept. And that's where every process produces only what's needed by the next, was needed by the next process in a continuous flow. So, and you only have the materials on hand to build what you need. You don't stockpile enormous, you know, amounts of material that you don't necessarily need or get to in that day or that hour or whatever. It's brought to you just in time to get the work done, and it really works.
And again, baffling to Western auto companies at the time, who were known for large inventories of parts.
Yeah, and that was kind of the thing is that, you know, in automobile manufacturing, you have a large stockpile of pieces or parts next to you, and you just continuously work throughout the day, and then, you know, that's refreshed whenever it is. Maybe it's, you know, at the beginning of the week. I don't know. But what you're left with is piles of materials that are left laying around. And I guess that's open to, you know, the possibility of, I would guess, rust or being bent or whatever. I mean,
sure.
I would think that, you know, just having stockpiles of material laying around is not a good thing, and it's not very cost effective.
No, and let's also remember how important profit margin and efficiency were at the time that Toyota was really rising up, which is during wartime.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Quite so frequently.
It's very, very smart way of production, and it's easy to see why the Western world grabbed onto that as well.
Yeah, and if you're an auto business and you're starting out, you're already so late to the game with these other companies, these other foreign companies manufacturing Japan's cars, right?
Yeah.
So how do you beat these guys? You don't have the distribution chains they have. You don't have the established access to resources. So you just become a lot more careful with what you do have.
Speaking of distribution, you want to move on to when Toyota came to the United States?
Yes, let's go all the way to the 50s, right?
Late 50s,
1957.
Halloween.
Yeah. Is it Halloween?
Halloween, yeah. Halloween in 1957. They opened up the United States headquarters, which was really, it's an old Rambler dealership in Hollywood, California, apparently, is where they started sales.
And they had the model they came out with was the Crown, right?
Yeah, the Toyopet Crown.
Toyopet Crown.
It was a sedan. Mm. That's right. And want to hear the sales numbers for 1958, following year?
Lay them on me.
A grand total of 288 vehicles were sold in 1958.
Oh, man.
288. Now, that means, looking at closer at the numbers, 287 Toyopet Crown sedans, one Toyota Land Cruiser was sold that year.
In the U.S.?
In the U.S.
Okay.
Now, what's really strange about this is that if we jump forward to, and we can go back a little bit, I guess, but
sure.
1966, they were selling 20,000 cars by 1966, which is pretty good, right?
Yeah, less than 10 years.
And here's the crazy thing is that the Toyopet, which sold, I'll say, so well in the first year, 287 out of the 288, that was found by the American consumers to be underpowered, overpriced, and not exactly what they had thought it was going to be. And the Land Cruiser, which only sold one vehicle in that initial year, was really quite a hit, I guess. It was the majority of the sales through about 1965, and that's when the Toyota Corona arrived. So they started coming out with new models in 1965, mm-hmm. but up until that point, they only had the two models, and the Land Cruiser really carried the company.
Brand.
Yeah, carried the company from about 1958 to 1966.
And things continue this way until 1968, because in 1968, Scott, a very recognizable car was released, the Corolla.
Corolla, yeah, that's right. A huge success in the U.S. Not just then, but continuing right through, several years, it was the best all-time selling vehicle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, do you know some of the facts and figures on this?
I don't have the numbers with me off the top.
It was actually, it's the world's all-time best-selling passenger car. It sold in 140 countries. 27 million vehicles were sold.
That's crazy.
27 million Corollas were sold. So this is a big success, not just in the U.S., but everywhere. Huge, huge popular vehicle.
And they continue working on this. They didn't stop at the Corolla, though. We can go – let's talk about some general stuff. One tradition we do see with Toyota is a lot of partnerships.
Mm-hmm.
There are quite a few partnerships, not just with other Japanese companies like Daihatsu Motor, but also with Western companies like GM.
Yeah. Yeah, they had some partnerships with engine building. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. For fabrication.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? We'll jump around in history here.
That's right. Here's the funny thing, because I've got several timelines I'm looking at here.
Yeah.
And some of the timelines are missing some information that I found elsewhere. So if I go back a little bit in these, and I know, Ben, you're doing the same thing.
Yeah.
It's tough because they don't quite fill in all the gaps. And if you have to look at many different sources to find out, what's exactly going on. So, when you say, like, in 1968, the Corolla happened, but, by 1967, Toyota was the number three best-selling brand in the United States. Now, that says something.
Huge.
Best-selling import brand in the United States, which is huge. That is big. And later, we're going to find out later about the history, where they are now.
Yes.
Kind of surprising. I mean, the way they jumped up in popularity.
It is very surprising. Let's take a second to go back with our parallel podcast here about the philosophy, because we never talked about those precepts or the conditions. I got them right here.
Sure.
I can run through them real quick.
Let's hear them.
Okay. There are – the lists I found had five. Okay. One, regardless of – position, work together to fulfill your duties faithfully and contribute to the development and welfare of the country, being, of course, Japan. Two, always stay ahead of the times through research and creativity. Three, avoid frivolity.
I think that's it.
Yeah. So don't be whimsical.
No horseplay. Yeah,
there
that's
we
always
go.
Rule number that's, seven that's on the would, ice rink.
That's how we would say it over here.
No horseplay.
It is rule number 30 or seven.
Yeah.
Wow.
At the pool and at the ice rink.
Why is that?
I don't know.
Okay, number four, be kind and generous. Strive to create a home-like atmosphere. And five, be reverent and conduct your life in thankfulness and gratitude. I will be honest with you, Scott. I find number five a little bit vague, but I am definitely not going to just dismiss out of hand these precepts, because they have obviously been successful by continuing to sort of take this worker approach. We should also talk about how they invest in equipment rather than people. And originally, Kichiro, when the company was just starting off, swore they would never lay off any workers.
Mm.
And due to the circumstances that later occurred, they were sort of forced into laying off people. And rather than do that, Kichiro resigned.
Really?
Uh-huh.
He stood behind his principles, huh?
Yes.
He said, I promised it. I won't do it.
And we won't go too much into the details of how that whole game worked out.
You know, Ben, you want to take a moment just to talk about, like, Toyota's rise in popularity, because they've really climbed through the years. I mean, by introducing different brands and just slowly climbing the ladder, I guess, is what they've been doing, really.
Yeah.
When you look at where they started and – you know, they started with what, 288 vehicles in the United States, is that what I said?
Yes. Selling that? 287
yeah,
of which were crowns.
It's getting just to astronomical numbers, really.
Oh, yes,
and,
sir.
So if you want to kind of go back with me here, they have the capacity to build about 2.2 million cars at this point, Ben. And by 2011, I think, is when they said that they were going to be able to do that.
Wow.
That's 2.2 million cars and trucks and 1.45 million engines in 15 plants all across North America. And this is just the United States production we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So, the numbers are just getting huge. I mean, they're built in California, Kentucky, Indiana, mm-hmm. West Virginia, Alabama, Tennessee, Texas, Missouri, and Mississippi. And, if you want to go back now, I was kind of shocked by this.
What's that?
Lexus wasn't around until 1989. I don't know why I find that amazing. I thought they were around a lot longer than that.
Really?
But I did, yeah. I mean, I'm an old timer. So 1989, I mean, that seems like it wasn't that long ago. But they debuted in 1989, and they debuted a little bit later, I think, in Japan. I think it was first launched here in the United States, and it was one of these things that, you know, by 1991, this is just 2 years later, Lexus was already the number one luxury import in the United States. Mm. They had already topped Mercedes and BMW.
Which is just nuts. That's bananas.
I can't believe that. I mean, it just seems strange that they would top the Germans 2 years after they had launched.
And they didn't introduce the Lexus brand to the hometown or to the home state of Japan until, what, 2005?
Something like that. It was a lot longer.
Late?
And I've got it, again, one of my many timelines I'm looking at here. But, it was a lot longer. So it had been around the United States for a while.
Mm-hmm.
If we kind of go through the timeline here again, December 1997, that's when Camry, with the well-known Camry at this point, mm-hmm. has earned the title of number one selling passenger car in America. So it that's a huge.
It is not an easy achievement.
Mile marker there at that point. I mean, it's really big. So it was in 2000 that the Prius came around, of course.
Mm-hmm.
2000, also in 2000, Lexus is now the top selling luxury brand in the United States. Mm-hmm. And that's a title that it has held apparently for 9 years at that point. Maybe even longer at this point.
And just a few years after selling, the first Prius, I think they hit over a million sold.
Yeah, they hit well over a million. As a matter of fact, they, if you want to go all the way to 2001, 2001, they became the third best selling automotive brand in the United States. They passed Dodge. So, you know, the big three that we always talk about, GM, Chrysler, Ford, they passed Dodge in 2001, and their sales were something like, you know, a million seven vehicles in the United States. It was more than that, actually.
Crazy.
So enormous growth at that point. Of course, there's hybrid synergy drive, which came around in 2004 with the Prius, and that's still around.
Yeah.
Let's see. Scion. They have Scion, you know, at that point. 2003, they launched the Scion brand, which is kind of for young, you know, youth-oriented urban drivers, is what they said. Huge success. And in 2004, they topped 2 million vehicles for the first time ever. So, you know, at this point, they're topping 2 million vehicles per sale. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, per year in the United States alone, which, you know, looking back again to 1957 at 288, that's incredible growth.
And just for some perspective, we're all familiar with the automobile company Honda.
Mm-hmm.
In the United States, Toyota has about double their sales.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it?
It's incredible, and a lot of people, a lot of, you know, business consultants and management gurus, if I could use the phrase, do trace this stuff back to Toyota's very philosophical approach to building cars.
You know, we mentioned the Camry being the number one selling car in the United States. At this point, Camry has been the number one selling car, still is, for the 11th time out of 12 years at this point. I think it was in 2009. I don't know about 2010. I have to look that up, but I think they stayed on top. Also in 2008, this is maybe the biggest marker here that I don't know if there is a bigger marker.
Lay it on me.
2008, although sales were down because, you know, the economic downturn.
Sure.
They still topped Chevrolet to take the number one selling brand in the United States spot. They sold more vehicles than GM, making it the number one world's largest automaker.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, okay, so we're going through, and I think the listeners are kind of getting the feeling that we have so much information here that it's difficult to condense it into one podcast. This is one of our iceberg podcasts, I think.
Yeah, I think so, because, I mean, we're talking about a company here that now worldwide in 2010, they built 8.42 million vehicles. Mm-hmm. 8.42 million worldwide. And we're talking about, you know, U.S. sales that are, you know, around 2.5 million, something sure. like that. But 8.42 million worldwide, and GM was just underneath them at 8.39. So, they are number one. That's Toyota. The list goes Toyota, GM, VW at this point. Volkswagen is very close. They're at, well, close relatively, I guess. They're, they're selling 7.14 million vehicles, just as a comparison. It's unbelievable the amount of vehicles we're talking about at this point, and they're huge, huge companies.
But we would be remiss if we did not mention that not all has been hunky-dory and rose-tinted glasses for Toyota through their history.
Correct.
I just get the feeling that, you know, when people hear the first part, they're thinking, why are these guys glossing over?
Now, sure, we're gushing about Toyota, right?
Well, we're gushing about the cool stuff, but let's also keep in mind people who've listened to our earlier podcasts have probably already heard about things like Toyota's massive recall a number of years back. We said they produced 8.42
million units in 2010.
And over the span of this recall for unintended acceleration, they had to recall nearly
8 million vehicles.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the recall cost them dearly.
Right, but recalls are always tremendously expensive and historically sometimes fatal to not just vehicles, but a manufacturer in general.
Yeah, true.
So if you have to recall cereal, you can still get, even though a box of cereal is so much cheaper.
Do you find that funny, Ben? Cereal? I heard you laugh.
I'm laughing because it makes me feel like – it feels like such a dangerous game. It's really risky.
I was kidding. I was just kidding. I heard you snicker there a little bit.
I am snickering because I'm thinking, you know, you build millions of iterations of a product, right? And if it's not good in the beginning, if there's something wrong with it, how do you catch it before it goes to 8 million?
Until you get 8 million out there and you have to bring them back at a significant cost each. That's a major undertaking.
I can't even handle it when I accidentally print something out with the formatting wrong. You know what I mean?
You have to print it twice.
Oh, and God forbid there's more than one copy.
Oh, sure. My color.
Oh, no. I can't even mess with it. Yeah. I have to evolve.
Yeah, yeah.
It looks like we have Toyota, despite some of its mistakes, you know, the Scion is in raw numbers successful, for instance, but the management of Toyota and a lot of analysts think that it didn't really live up to what they wanted it to
do. I've heard that. There's some there are low customer return numbers for Scion. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, down at near the bottom of the list, I think was Chrysler and Scion, and you know, there's some surprising return. You know, people that own a vehicle from that manufacturer, do they go back and buy from that manufacturer again? And I know that Scion was pretty low on that list.
And there are some demographics that are difficult to predict. That's for the Scion was intended or is intended, I guess, for more to bring a younger, hipper demographic. Mm-hmm.
I think overall success.
I would say, but
I think so.
We don't know what they wanted inside the boardroom.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Cause it's not another Camry.
True.
So I guess what we're trying to do here at the end is just say that we know this company's not perfect. It is impressive, I think.
Yeah, agreed. It's the number one world's largest automaker.
Oh, man.
That's always impressive.
I want a factory tour. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I wonder if we can finagle that somehow.
Oh, I'm sure that's possible.
Is it in the budget?
Maybe. Yeah, maybe.
Well, while we're going to go check on our budget, we're going to scoot. You won't have to listen to us shuffle paper and numbers anymore. But do check us out. Tell us what you think about Toyota's history. Tell us what you think about the history of other car companies. Would you like to hear more?
Maybe some of the stuff we've forgot in our timelines here, because they're, like we said, they're gaps that they're just not filled in even the three or four that we're looking at.
Yeah.
So please let us know what's going on.
And the best ways for someone to do that are, of course, to check us out on Facebook. Give us a holler at Twitter. Check out our blog and our website. But if you want to cut right to the quick of the matter, send us an email at
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.
Managing your diabetes just got easier. The powerful new Dexcom G7 lets you see your glucose numbers on your compatible watch and phone without fingersticks. And because Dexcom G7 is the most accurate CGM system, you can be confident in your food, exercise, and medication decisions. And all those decisions can lead to big results, like more time in range and lower A1C. Get started at Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com/compatibility.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This episode brought to you by 20th Century Studios' Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Director Wes Ball breathes new life into the epic franchise. As a ruthless king attempts to build his empire at the expense of the remaining human race, a young ape begins a journey to fight for a future for apes and humans alike. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Enter the kingdom in IMAX this Friday and theaters everywhere. Get tickets now.